We will call the meeting to order. We do not have a quorum yet, so we are not officially called to order. We will take care of some issues when we do have a quorum here. I'd like to thank the members that are here for being here on time. And today's agenda is on House File 4041. The motion will be to move the bill to the Rules Committee because it has been requested by the Environment Policy Committee. But we can only go out of rules at this point, this late date in the game. So that's what the motion will be. And we're going to take testimony on House File 4041. I'd like to have members look at the agenda here. We're very honored today to have Commissioner of Department of Natural Resources, Gene Merriam, here. Then we have Harry Gallagher, an attorney, with Lockridge Grindle and Nowen, and Dick Sternberg, Rebecca Cluckhone, and then John Reynolds. And I would like to ask the question if there is anyone else that would like to testify on the bill today. We will run it. Basically, we'll start out with the commissioner. Then we will go with proponents of the aquaculture water use permitting fee bill. We'll be asking some questions as to what it boils down to for me right now if someone, an entrepreneur, someone wanted to start an aquaculture business in the state of Minnesota, how would they do it? Because from what we've been through on this, I'm beginning to wonder if any new aquaculture farms could even be started in today's atmosphere. So that's kind of what we're looking at here. Okay, so Commissioner Merriam, if you could please join us. Welcome to the committee, Commissioner, and basically what we'd like to look at today here is we will have the bill before us when we have a quorum, but I guess if maybe you could address some remarks to the future of Greg David's aquaculture farms wanting to start an aquaculture farm in Minnesota in Kandy, Ojai County. How would I do that? What would it take to do that? And who would I go through? Because, Commissioner, what we found out at our last meeting was aquaculture is regulated through the Department of Agriculture, yet they came up and testified that they have nothing to do with it. So we were kind of perplexed by that response, or at least the chair was. And if we could just open it up. Let's first of all go to the bill, what the department's position is on the bill. Joe, could you get the commissioner a copy of the bill? If you please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Mr. Chairman and members, I'm Gene Merriam, Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources, and maybe addressing your last question first. Mr. Chairman, you asked our position on the bill.
Yes.
I'm sorry, I did not come here prepared to address a particular bill today.
Okay.
And I don't know that we have a position on
this. Okay. Okay, that's fair enough.
And the earlier question you asked, I think, is a good one because, and I have a number of our fisheries and waters people here today, Mr. Chairman. I know we've had some conversations in regards to a number of these issues. And as a matter of fact, I can't remember the year, but there's a cutoff date in there that would not allow for. Maybe I could ask Mr. Ron Fire, our fisheries.
Certainly.
Come up and join me here. And he's got the statutes in his hand and would be able to answer the question that would not allow an activity that the use of water from a connected water basin. You want to cite that, Ron? And
Mr. Chairman, members, Ron Payer with DNR Fish and Wildlife, and the statute that I'm looking at is Minnesota Statutes Chapter 174984, Subdivision 2B, and it basically indicates that waters that are continually connected by a permanent water course to other waters must not be approved for aquatic farm use, and then it gives some exceptions. And in some cases, and Spring Valley Creek is an example of that, if you had a license for given species and waters prior to 1992, those licenses were grandfathered in. And so there's been a change in these statutes. since 1992. But under current law, we would not allow, we would not be able to approve waters to be licensed if they were permanently connected to public waters.
So I'm not going to do well, Mr. Pryor, in Candio High County.
Well, Mr. Chairman, there's some options. I'm not aware of too many new trout facilities that have started up. I know in some cases they pump groundwater. You obviously need colder water temperatures to grow trout, and so you either need a kind of a spring source of some type, groundwater or through a that you pump or through a natural spring. And there would be maybe some opportunities to do that, but it'd be unlikely on a trout stream, on a flowing trout stream.
Okay. What about the case of, for example, Spring Valley Ponds, where it's not on a trout stream, but it empties into a trout stream?
Mr. Chairman, the I think the determination that we've made is that tributaries to a trout stream are considered designated, and they are considered part of that trout stream.
But I guess it really doesn't apply because they had a license or a permit before 1992.
Mr. Chairman, in terms of licensing that facility as it was operated in 1992 for the species they were licensed for, that's correct.
What happens now that there's a commissioner's order to pull the hatchery license? How does that affect, would you say now that he doesn't have a license, so he doesn't qualify under the grandfather, or since he had it before 92, would he still grandfather in for those specific species?
Mr. Chairman, the commissioner in his letter laid out several things, and one was to remove the license waters. It didn't remove the license because Mr. Bondas, who operates Spring Valley Creek, had another license for other facilities, but based on, again, Chapter 1749-84, where it's you go into Subdivision 1E, it said a license issued by the commissioner is not a determination of private property rights, but is only based on a determination that the licensee does not have significant detrimental impact on the public resource. And the commissioner can certainly answer that, but didn't feel that we had enough information on the operating plans for Spring Valley after the changes in the spring and the change in the channel to make that determination.
Okay. Now, members, excuse me.
Did we get an answer? I want to know if we got an answer.
Yeah, it was clearly maybe, possibly we could.
Okay.
All right, that's the way
that point.
Representative Moe, to that point.
Yeah, just to be clear then for my purpose here, the man, the farm in question here had a permit prior to 92, but not for what he's accomplished wanting to do now. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, prior? Representative Moe. The license was owned by another individual, and the request was made to transfer those licensed waters to Mr. Bondas. And in the meantime, Mr. Bondas had made significant changes in the spring by concrete structure and PVC pipe and changing the configuration and the channel of that tributary. And with those changes, then the department felt we needed to review whether or not those changes would result in significant environmental impact. So we've tried to work with Mr. Bondas to work out an operating plan to mitigate any negative resource impact.
Mr. Chairman,
and Mr. Bondas, has he been able to meet your request, or has he chosen not to, or?
Mr. Pyre?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Moe, we've been working, I think the first letter and the interactions that I'm aware of were in August of 2003. So we've tried to get a site plan, and I think in December we received a site plan from Mr. Bondas, and we've kind of gone back and forth to refine that site plan right now. And Spring Valley Ponds had a request that we provide them with guidelines on what would be the temperature parameters that would be acceptable to protect the trout resource in Spring Valley Creek. So we provided that, and we met a week ago Monday with Mr. Bondas and the consultants to determine whether or not he felt he could operate with the criteria that had been established. And I think at this point, that's what's going on. The folks that are modeling the temperature regimes, the consultant for Mr. Bondas and staff from our Division of Waters, are trying to work out whether or not there was some new information provided, whether or not that temperature regime was still the same or if it would change based on the new information.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So the DNR is not necessarily opposed to this operation. You've just put some requirements for Mr. Bondas to meet, and the DNR is meeting with his consultant trying to reconcile those two positions, correct?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. And, you know, it might be helpful if we distributed a document that I think captures the history and the identification of the facts and the matters that are in dispute, if you will. And it's the one that we just issued that I signed off on a week ago. So,
Commissioner, do we have that?
Well, I don't know. I was going to make that available to you.
Joel, if you could pass out the form, sir.
Maybe going back to the previous question, there's no dispute about the fact that the hatchery had a license well before 1992, so it was grandfathered in under that law. When, as you'll see in the document being distributed, we suspended that license, we suspended the listing of that water, the Spring Valley water, on that license. Because the way it works is individuals, and Mr. Bondas had a license at covering a number of facilities. When he bought this facility from his previous owner, who had a hatchery license, the statute gives the seller and the buyer, as a matter of statutory right, the right to transfer. We recognized that, and the listing was changed from the previous licensee to Mr. Bondas' license. So the water is a listed water, previously licensed. There's no question it meets the grandfathering requirement.
Representative Ball? Okay, we're going to go to Representative Wellston and Johnson. Before we do, the commissioner is having the page pass out some information. State of Minnesota Office of Administrative Hearings, if members could please look at that.
We have a quorum. Yeah.
Okay, excuse me for a second. We'll officially call the meeting to order. We do have a quorum. Representative Magnus has reviewed the minutes from April 19th. Are there any additions or corrections to the minutes? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. So members, Commissioner Merriam, I don't want to get in trouble here. First of all, I preface all of our meetings with, it's all about the environment. We need to keep the environment in good shape, and that's what your job is, that's what our job is, and that's what we do around here. I notice that this is a notice and order for pre-hearing conference. Now, I haven't talked to any Supreme Court judges on this issue, but it looks like this is in court right now, or is it administrative hearings, or where are we at?
Mr. Chairman, this is in the Office of Administrative Hearings.
So we're not going to get in trouble?
It's not top secret?
It's not
a judicial matter at this point. It's an executive branch matter in the Office of Administrative. It's a public document, so it's not sharing anything that would give any of us in trouble.
Representative Moe, you asked the question if the DNR has any opposition to it. I don't know if they do, other than they pull the license and have them in court.
No.
Representative Welty.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the Commissioner, as I understand it, if Mr. Bondhus would not have done anything to modify the flow of the spring water that was going to the stream, you would have renewed his license, or if he would have kept everything the same when he took ownership of the hatchery, if he would have left everything the same, would you have renewed his license?
Commissioner Merriam?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Welty, yes, except I think the distinction is not a matter of renewing the license. The license is perpetual, if you will, absent anything causing revocation or suspension.
Representative Welty?
Thank you, then, Mr. Chair, and to the Commissioner. So, as I understand it, Mr. Bondhus did something to cause you to revoke his license, then. Is that correct?
Commissioner Maria?
Chairman, Representative Welty, that's right. And if I could refer you to page 4 of that document, once you get past the administrative niceties in the first several pages, it begins to list the factual problems and what led us to take the license revocation, or to actually to remove this waters from the listed waters on Mr. Bonas's license, and also to issue the cease and desist order and the restoration order.
Well, Commissioner, I see, and members, you have in one of your green folders, I think it's the second green folder, not the one that has the bill, on the last page, we have John Bonas, Springway Ponds, LLC permits applied, pending, needed, and received. And if you go down to number 5, I believe that would refer to the concrete structure, the county building permit. The county zoning engineer was there when they poured the concrete. And I believe it was the understanding of Mr. Bondas, and I could be corrected if I'm incorrect here, that he had full approval to do that since the county zoning engineer was there. Now, Commissioner, who actually had I thought the county had the ability to issue or to allow that to happen, to allow that concrete to be poured. I believe that was in the purview of the county, and unless I'm incorrect in that, Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know what the county's requirements are, but under the state statutory and regulatory framework, it requires, for work done in a public waters, it requires a public waters permit issued by the Department of Natural Resources.
Now, that is not on any, that spring coming in is not on any map as a designated trout stream, is it? Or does that matter?
Mr. Chairman, I think when the designated waters, when the inventory was first done, I do not believe that spring was on the quad map, but the statute that designates trout streams indicates that tributaries within the sections that's designated are part of the designated waters. And
so it really could be up to interpretation if he did something wrong or not. I mean, the county guys stand right there while they're pouring concrete. He probably thinks he can do it.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think that I think that the Division of Waters has determined that when he did that constituted an appropriation, and that we thought it was pretty clear that he was diverting a tributary to a trout stream. That's one of the agency's primary determinations, that tributary to that trout stream was through the work in the spring and the change in how the water was flowing through his facility constituted a diversion of that tributary, and that's what triggered kind of the environmental assessment mandate.
Part of the, what did he divert? He didn't divert anything. Yeah, it's just concrete there. Well, how's the diversion?
Yeah,
I mean, the water is going from one place to the other just like before. It's going to the same place.
Not quite, Mr. Chairman. It's going. Maybe we can show on the maps what's happening there. But you know, let me if with your indulgence, Mr. Chairman, and to get back to Representative Moore's question as to whether we would have permitted this is somewhat still hypothetical, because what we've been trying to get for the last 2.5 years is answers to questions like, what is it you're proposing to do? I mean, even after we discovered the work was done, the concrete in the public waters and the rest of the work done in the public waters without a permit, we didn't go in there to shut them down and yank his license. We went in there to find out, get some data, get some plans. And that's not been forthcoming. We were in a position, as I'm sure the members of this committee are well aware, that trout streams are very sensitive from several perspectives that can be impacted by work done in and around the trout stream. The concern about sedimentation, the concern about temperature raising, that will destroy a relatively fragile ecosystem. So,
Mr. Fisher, how does a concrete slab, though, change any of that? Because he didn't. It still goes into the ponds before it goes into the creek.
Mr. Chairman, Scott Lacus, Moa Division of Waters for DNR.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you. There's two permits that could potentially be involved. One is work in public waters, and there is a debate on whether or not this spring and tributary are public waters. Regardless of that, the appropriation of water, which is the withdrawal, removal, or transfer of water from its source, regardless of how the water is used, is an appropriation. And if you exceed 10,000 gallons a day or 1 million gallons a year, a permit is required. It's clear that an appropriation permit is required for the use of this water in the facility.
Mr. Rockenwell, when Mr. Bondas had the county zoning commissioner, who I know very well, is a very well-respected zoning commissioner, was standing there watching him pour concrete, do you think he maybe thought that it was okay, that he probably didn't need a permit since the county was allowing him to do this?
Mr. Chairman, he may have. I don't know what he was thinking.
Calls for speculation. Okay, we're to that point?
That point,
Representative Kinstead.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize if I jumped in front of it, but to that point, I just built a house. I went to the county and I got the permits. I'm a legislator. I don't know exactly which statute. I trusted my county to give me the permit to say, yep, you can put the cement slab here for your basement. So, Mr. Chair, to your point, I mean, I completely understand what you're saying. You know, we have to trust our local officials, and if you go in for a county permit and the county says, yes, you're fine, I would say, you know, to the commissioner or whoever up there, then, so are you suggesting that maybe this individual should have read up on the state statutes quick to make sure the county was doing the right thing and allowing them to build this?
Mr. Lacasmo or prior commissioner?
Whoever.
Mr. Chairman,
Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure what the expectation is when an individual begins work and talks to a government official and thinks that the one official or the local official is sufficient. I would be sheer conjecture on my part as to what I might expect the county administrator to advise the person to do. Given the fact that this individual was already licensed by the Department of Natural Resources and had some familiarity with hatchery operations, had some history in that, I think that it springs credulity to believe that he didn't have to get a permit from the Department of Natural Resources for work done in the trout stream.
But Commissioner wasn't on a trout stream. He was on a spring going into ponds that eventually went to trout stream. He didn't change that flow. It's still going to go to the ponds of the trout stream. I don't see where the effect of a concrete slab or a concrete container affects what comes out the back end. Well, Representative Welty still has the floor here. Representative Welty.
Yeah.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The first question is for any of the three testifiers. We've been talking a lot about the concerns of the temperature of the water that has been borrowed from the spring. That after it's taken and is used in various ways in these ponds, it will then be returned to the trout stream. The temperature, of course, is an issue. As a non-specialist here, I would have some questions about would there be any pathogens or viruses or bacteria or of any description that might be of concern to trout farther downstream that might be introduced in this procedure.
Commissioner? Or Mr. Fire?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, that's a concern that we have, and part of the request we had for a site plan was to address those issues. What were the effluent discharge plans? What were the plans? And most hatcheries can comply with reasonable disease certification and work through that. The concerns from the fisheries and certainly our temperature, pathogens or species that are reared in that facility that might escape into the other waters of the state, and then whatever the discharge in terms of a sediment or other things might be during the course of the year. Those would be some of the things that we'd look for. It's expanded beyond that, but just as a summary, those would be the type of main concerns we'd have from a fishery standpoint.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's a concern that I share very much as a citizen, because knowing that we have to do everything we can to protect clean air and clean water for future generations, it seems to me even a borrowing of the waters of the state for this purpose lends opportunity for all kinds of mischief in the form of either escaped a species of one kind or another, or what I'm more concerned about is possible contamination to the water that might affect humans, or certainly the trout that would be expected to live and in the stream downstream and provide recreation and whatnot for other citizens of the state of Minnesota. Do I understand then that you have not received documents or specifications that would from Mr. Bondas that would address these concerns?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Johnson, we have, when we get a hatchery, an aquaculture permit, we do approve the species that operator is allowed to rear in those waters. So there is an approved species list for his facility. So in terms of fish species, we have that information. We've established the temperature parameters, and Mr. Bondas is now working to see if a 55-degree discharge would work for the type of operation. What we would like to analyze would be the more specific operating plans on when he might discharge, what type of treatment might he be using for disease. Those are kind of the details that we would are still looking for, but I suspect that most of those in terms of disease can be fairly easily taken care of. So the temperature issue and discharge, when that operator might drain those ponds are the issues that are, from the fisheries perspective, are the most outstanding issues right now.
Well, Mr. Pyre, how does the effect of coming from the spring into a concrete slab or container and then going into the ponds affect anything differently from what comes out of the ponds? I understand what Representative Johnson is saying, but I don't think that the concrete slab affects that at all.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, and that may be true. What impacts the temperature is how the water flows through the ponds and how long it's sitting in the ponds. And ultimately, from the temperature concern, we're not as concerned how he uses that water within the ponds, but the effluent discharge. What's the discharge ultimately after he's used that water into the stream? And we've determined, particularly during the warm water months, that 55 degrees Fahrenheit is probably about the most that would be feasible to make sure that we maintain the cold water that's necessary in Spring Valley Creek. So a little bit different related issues in terms of appropriation, whether or not that structure was placed without the permit. So the temperature issue is more related to how long that water is held, how much of an opportunity it has to warm up, and then what's that temperature when it's finally discharged into Spring Valley Creek.
Which really has nothing to do, Mr. Pyre, with the concrete pouring.
Mr. Chairman, those two issues would be separate issues, the temperature and the concrete pouring.
Mr. Chairman,
to that point, or you still have the floor to Representative Moe to that point?
A couple quick clarifications. Just for the sake of the committee here, just describe the temperature range for trout and how that could be real detrimental. And then the last question I'd like to ask you is, do you think that Mr. Bonhoff can meet the requirements that you've requested?
Mr. Pyre?
Are there other examples? I mean, is this abnormal?
Mr. Pyre?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Moe, to the first question, trout require fairly cold water. Brown trout are a bit more tolerant, and that's the species we have in Spring Valley Creek. We'd like to see temperatures not exceeding, in the stream, the upper 60s or low 70s. Spring Valley, the spring that feeds Spring Valley Creek, lowers that water temperature in the stream by about 9 degrees. So it's really a significant drop, and that's what helps sustain the trout stream.
Because more oxygen and cold water.
Cold water, and they require the cooler temperatures. They're just they've adapted to that cold water. So from that aspect, the spring there is a major contributor. It's probably what helps sustain that trout fishery below that. As to the question, can Mr. Bondas operate at 55 degrees? It may alter what his operational plans are. That was a temperature discharge that we'd measured back in, I think, 1987 from the previous operator. And when we had some staff here, and we have some of the folks that did the specifics, when they modeled that, they felt that was a reasonable temperature. So he would be able to meet that and rear some fish, whether or not he would be able to operate as he planned. I'm not sure. I'm not really sure where he wanted to operate.
Chair Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Which page would be available, please? I have some documents here that may shed some light on the discussion before us today. These were prepared by the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. And a specific question raised in the timeline that you will see before you in this list here. Apparently, the proposed operation here is currently under a cease and desist order from the DNR. What does that mean?
Commissioner Murray?
That means that they're required to stop doing what they're doing. That's the cease and desist part. And the restoration order is to fix what they've already done, to undo what they've done. Now, when you say that they're under that order's been issued, but they, under the Administrative Procedures Act, their authority to appeal from that, which places it in abeyance, has been exercised. And that's what we are now in a contested case hearing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, then this may shed some light on another question I had. I'd seen a flyer come around the offices recently about a first annual free fishing day out at Spring Valley Ponds, which was held on Sunday, April 30th, I gather. At least that's what the flyer says. Would that have been in compliance with the expectations currently held of Spring Valley Ponds by the DNR procedures?
Mr. Fire?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, no. What the on the fish end, Mr. Bondas was given 60 days notice to remove all the fish from the facility because they were no longer licensed waters. And as the commissioner indicated when the appeal came in, that has been on hold. So he has the amount of time in between to remove those fish or transfer those fish in whatever means is legal to do. So
a fishing party would have been legal?
Yes. Would not have been.
I guess it's a good order to do it. First M. Johnson?
Well, I will remain puzzled about the possibility of pathogens. I'm really stuck on that particular issue. Mr. Chair, as you know, I have a huge interest in methane digester technology and the role that it plays in helping make the waters that are in feedlot lagoons less harmful to the environment, at least potentially, because of the destruction of pathogens in the methane digester treatment process. And I know if there are leaks from a feedlot lagoon that can have a harmful impact on groundwater, it raises questions for me. What might be contained in water discharge from a trout hatchery that might prove potentially hazardous to the waters of the state? And I'm satisfied that you've answered my questions on that, but it's something that I remain concerned about. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Here, Representative Junkie, then Pastor Representative Junkie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize I wasn't here at the last meeting. I was over at the University of Minnesota at a lecture series that day, but maybe just some geographical information to get me caught up here. What's the length of this trout stream that we're talking about? Miles, or how long is it? Since I don't see a map or anything in my...
I believe it's 11.8 or somewhere in there.
11, 12 miles, something like that. What orientation-wise, where is this farm located, upstream, downstream? Is it in the upper third, the upper fourth, the lower half? I mean, where orientation-wise, where is it at?
Mr. Fire?
Mr. Chairman, I'll ask Jason Mecca, who's our trout supervisor in southeast Minnesota. He can give more detailed information on this.
Okay, why don't you just pull a chair up? You can stay here, Mr. Parr. We've got more questions. If you just pull the chair up and just grab one of those. Can you please state your name and who you represent for the record, please?
Mr. Chairman, Jason Meckel, Minnesota DNR Fisheries in Rochester.
Welcome to committee, sir.
Thank you. The Spring Valley Hatchery is located 10 miles upstream from the mouth of the stream. It extends another couple of miles up into the town of Spring Valley.
And, Mr. Chair, how many total springs feed this river? What's the dependency of the river on spring flow? How many springs are along that 11 or 12 mile stretch that feed this?
Mr. Meckel? Mr.
I didn't bring the file with me from our survey, but if memory serves, it's in the order of 20 or so inventoried springs or seeps. What we do in a survey is we'll walk the whole stream, look for these springs or seeps. This particular spring is the single largest spring on Spring Valley Creek.
And thank you, Mr. Chair, for that information. I see that I'm looking at the paperwork that the commissioner handed out at the from the hearing. It says a public waters works permit should have been issued before the work was done, according to the DNR. Are all springs and seeps public waters in the state?
Mr. Meckel, or Mr. Lockesfall?
Mr. Chairman, no.
And, Mr. Chair, and to the witnesses, what then determines why this one is and others are not?
Mr. Lockesmo?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Junkie. Springs and seeps, public waters are defined as trout streams and their tributaries. For a tributary, it would have to have a definable bed and banks. So it's not just a seep coming out of the side of a hill that's directing water to the stream. So it's something that has a definable bed and banks. It's a tributary to the trout stream proper.
And, Mr. Chair, this spring then has a bed and bank, a definable bed and bank, and has historically, back to beginning of time?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Junkie, certainly this site has been significantly altered, but the spring has got a it's relatively large capacity spring, 2,000 gallons per minute. So there would have, in the natural state, before there were any ponds here at all, would have there been a definable channel? Yes. And, it's been manipulated over time. And so these various ponds are what make up most of the channel or the conveyance to the trout stream proper.
Which have been permitted in the past and have been fine.
Mr. Chairman, they were permitted as a trout stream. I don't believe there were ever any permits issued as far as excavation in public waters or altering public waters. And they may have been done prior to the need for those permits. I'm not exactly sure of the timing.
If there's no excavation, how did the ponds get there?
Mr. Chairman, there was excavation. What I'm saying is I don't believe there was a permit issued for the excavation. The excavation may have been done prior to
World War II.
And that would have been prior to the permit requirements.
Right. Yeah. Person Jumpy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What's the level of flow that you need to have a permit for water use in the state? How much per minute? How much per day?
For a water appropriation permit, and I do have a handout that would kind of lay that out.
Like an irrigation? Like,
yeah. 10,000 gallons a day or 1 million gallons a year. If you exceed those quantities of appropriation, an appropriation permit is needed.
Thank you. I guess one of the curious things that I'm trying to establish or figure out here, too, I'm kind of following Representative David's, as I read, DNR has determined that I'm on page 4, number 8. DNR has determined that unauthorized construction and an appropriation of public waters may, and I underline the word may,
have a detrimental impact on Spring Valley Creek and its trout fishery by increasing the temperature of the spring water discharged into the creek. So that was the main reason for the order given to remove the structures, lifters, distribution system, etc. Has the DNR proved that there is a detrimental impact on Spring Valley Creek? Again, I ask because I see that Bondhus constructed in 03. We're in the middle, going into summer of 06 at this point in time. I guess my question is, in the last 3 years, have we seen then the destruction or the lessening of the trout population in the stream, the water quality downstream? We're 10 miles up. What's the water quality a mile down, 5 miles down, 10 miles down? In my mind anyway, I would think there's enough. You must have put something together by now to prove that there's a substantial detrimental impact on Spring Valley Creek. And do we have that available somewhere here in our information?
Mr. Pyre?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Junkie, we don't have that determination. We don't know exactly how Mr. Bondus plans to operate the facility, and I don't believe he's been anywhere near capacity because he's trying to figure out what the parameters are. And our concern, that's exactly the genesis of our concern. If under different operating regimes, how is that going to change the temperature effluent? When would he drain his ponds? That's the information we've been going back and forth over the past 3 years trying to determine through a site plan. And we had asked Mr. Bondus for that information, and recently he said it would be good for them, for the agency, the DNR, to provide them with the temperature sideboards, and then he could determine what his operational plan would be. And that's what we provided over the past few months, and that's kind of where we're working out. So we haven't made a determination one way or the other yet because we're not sure exactly how he intends to operate the facility. And that's the type of information that we're working with Mr. Bondus and his consultants to try to determine exactly how will he operate and will that have an impact on the resource. We don't know the answer.
Mr. Chair, I guess, so I'm struggling here because I'm uncertain how your order to restore public waters by removing the concrete structures, lifters, distribution system, and outfalls constructed, how this moves us forward in this process. How does he removing all of this do anything to calm fears, ease fear? I mean, we wouldn't know if there's any detriment if this stuff is removed. Aren't we an experiment in process at this point, I guess is what I'm asking you. By removal of this gets us nowhere whatsoever, because then we're back to modeling. We actually have actual data we can collect now based on his usage in these structures. So how does removing them, it seems to me what we're doing is setting this up to end up in claims committee someday, where he's going to, because of this order, he's going to want some monetary repayal of what he's invested here if somehow you're proved wrong in the courts or, you know, whatever. I don't know what the outcome of this is ultimately going to be, but how does removing everything now advance this problem to its conclusion?
Mr. Pyre? Mr. Lockesbaum.
Mr. Chairman, and Representative Chunky, basically issuing the order sets in motion two things. One, Mr. Bondus could just comply with the order and be done with it. He could demand a hearing, which he's done, which puts us into an administrative review process. And while that is, it's actually going down a dual path right now. And a hearing, you should know, is de novo. It's as if the department had made no decision. So if it goes to a hearing, we would present our information, Mr. Bondus would present his information, and administrative law judge would make a recommendation on how to resolve that. The parallel path that we're going down, though, is continuing to have discussions and to see if the issues that we see with this facility can be addressed. It seemed at our last meeting a week ago, the previous Monday, that could they meet the 55 degree temperature discharge? Yes, with a certain number of ponds. If they're going to add more ponds, it might go higher. We're in the process of looking at developing a monitoring to develop more data to see which ponds can be operated how, and to see if that if there is a proposed operation that meets those criteria and also meets Mr. Bondas' needs for his hatchery operation.
Sir, Junkie. Well, and again, I missed last meeting, so I certainly don't know what Mr. Bondas' plans are, and I guess that's what you're working out with him right now. But I'm glad to hear that he doesn't, at least at this point, have to remove these structures, because I honestly, that seems insane to me that we would go that route until we have some concrete information. And again, I'm glad to hear, and I hope that DNR is continuing to be down there and taking fish counts and temperatures and bacterial information from the discharge site, but also then down the river to understand exactly, is this a detriment or not? Because again, your whole synopsis here is based on public waters may have a detrimental impact, but until I suggest that you do have some burden of proof, at least in this country, for most of us, we are innocent until proven guilty. And again, you have a may have detrimental impact, so I would hope that you're continuing to monitor and suggest ways that that this structure and this farm would be fine in compliance. I guess the only other thing that bothers me too, and it's not necessarily for this hearing, but for policy and discussions into the future, and we've run into this before, you know, the bed and bank definition troubles me, that, you know, we can go back to a point in time where none of us were alive, probably. I'm looking at the audience, but none of us were alive when there may have been a bed and bank there, and now we're surmising that because there may have been a bed and bank there at one point in time in history, that this now becomes, by definition, a public water. You know, we have the same problem with our septic systems. When we looked at modeling as a guideline for high water marks, that modeling could have happened hundreds of thousands of years ago in the glaciation periods, yet we were still using the graying in the soil or the modeling as a definition for high water is when we were setting our septics. And we made some adjustments to that last year based on science and common sense as we are evolving in the way we look at waters and usage in the state. And to me, this bed and bank maybe deserves a discussion like that somewhere along the line too, because yeah, we can go back a long ways in history and probably find anything we want along the way, but to all of a sudden say this is a public water, but the majority, I suspect, of other springs and seeps in this state are not public waters, I think is another question that needs to be resolved in this whole process.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, at the risk of appearing too argumentative, but I think it's important because it's fundamental to our whole permitting structure to have this discussion. I would agree, Representative Junkie, what you described, an ongoing experiment. And unfortunately, the problem is N equals one, and this is destructive sampling. If it creates a problem, we've lost the trout stream. It's darn hard to replace. So, as a consequence, our system of permitting is based upon applicant, you show us you're not going to do any harm. It's not incumbent upon the state, when you talk about a burden of proof, to prove that somebody that's going to use the natural resources of the state, that the government's got to show they're going to do harm. I think we have to keep that focus. And like I say, it's not desiring to be argumentative, but the way we approach it is the applicant has to demonstrate to us that if, that when you use the natural resources of the state, you are doing no harm. Not that we have to demonstrate that what you're about to do is going to cause harm.
Right. And just briefly, Mr. Chair, I was done, but just to continue the debate. Again, I'm reading your words that were handed in here, and you know, DNR has determined that the authorization, unauthorized construction in and appropriation of public waters may have a detrimental impact. And again, a lot of things may happen, but until they are happening, and again, I don't know what his plans are or were, and so I'm missing a piece here, obviously, and I admit that. I mean, if he's going to be four times the size and have five more ponds dug in, and the effluent and the bacterial counts will vary greatly in the future based on that is one thing, but under current operations, where he's sitting today, does that farm have a detrimental impact on Spring Valley Creek and its trout fish hatchery? For any reason, have we seen decreases in fish counts? Have we seen actual levels of bacteria or other things that we think will kill the trout fish hatchery or have a detrimental effect on it? We can actually look at that today, can't we?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnkey, yes, we can, but the problem is not fully operational.
Well, and again, that's the piece I'm missing, Mr. Commissioner. And
Representative Johnkey, we will get to that. Okay. We will get to that point. We have consulted.
And that's the piece I'm missing here, too.
And that's the piece we're missing.
Right.
See, that's the problem. We don't know the plan.
Okay.
Maybe we're making some progress here.
Well, we're all about progress. I'm going to go to Pennis and then Johnson, but I'm going to go to me first. Oh, Mo had one to that point.
Well, I think the commissioner answered the point. In environmental studies, in general, we have what's called the precautionary principle. The burden of proof has to be upon the person who's permitting, and that's obviously a challenge for this committee, but had we actually applied that principle, we wouldn't have zebra mussels, we wouldn't have rusty crayfish, we wouldn't have Eurasian milfoil, many of the things that the DNR is consistently trying to battle now in order to protect our fisheries. So, the position they're taking is because of great precedent in the history of our fisheries. This is, you know, not because they're in any way wanting to keep aquaculture out, I don't think. I think it's based on many of our desire to protect our fisheries.
Well, Representative Moy, my fish farm in Kandy, Ohio County just got killed today. I can't do it today. So
I didn't know you were, Mr. Chairman, I didn't know you were playing.
But it's been squashed today. With that being said, to the Commissioner, Mr. Pyrlakis Moe, or Mr. Meckel, I was reading a very interesting article written by someone that I have a tremendous amount of respect for. I think he's just one of the geniuses of our society. Mr. Jeff Broberg, in the Fillmore County Journal, and I say that seriously, I mean...
Sid Hartman?
Oh, yeah. Oh, he beat Sid Hartman all over the place. I mean, it's not even close. Not even close. But I like the DNR's opinion in some of his writing here. It's titled Broberg. It says, Trout Farm didn't follow the rules and now wants legislative remedy. And there's a sentence in there that says, we now have Representative David's committee reviewing the owner's request for forgiveness. Commissioner, do you understand what that means? Am I trying to give forgiveness here, in your opinion?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. I'm not sure the I'm not sure what you're asking me.
Well, there's several points here by Mr. Brover. I just wanted the department to go on record. Since the order's been issued, it says, and finally comply with conditions and regulations in your permit. Has Mr. Bondas complied with everything since the order was issued, in your opinion? That you're aware of? I mean, has he, when you issued your order, has he complied with provisions of your order?
Mr. Chairman, no, he's not complied with the order. He's opted to use his statutory right to appeal.
So he's in line in doing that. That's fine.
Yes.
Okay. And then it says, and now Mr. Bondu seeks special treatment from the legislature. Now, I'm not sure where that comes from because the bill we have applies to all of aquaculture. We believe that Mr. Bondus in House File 4041 would specifically, as this says, be getting special treatment from the legislature, or would it apply to all aquaculture in the state?
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Lockesmall,
I can answer that. If you look on the handout that I provided, there are 166 aquaculture permits. There are there's 48 active appropriation permits. Not all of those hit those thresholds and need appropriation permits. And to trip the $750 limit that is in House File 4041, you would have to have an appropriation of 188 million gallons a year of water to hit that number. None of the existing appropriations, aquaculture appropriations, would hit that level. And Mr. Bondas's application, so far, with the fees that he's paid, he hasn't hit that limit. But if he were fully operational at 21 million gallons per month, he would slightly exceed the $750 limit. He'd be up at $1,260.
But Mr. Locksmall, wouldn't the bill that was written apply to every fish farm in the state?
Mr. Chairman, yes, it would.
Thank you. Okay, now I'd like to go to, in your packets, the...
Chair?
Yes, to that point.
Well, I feel a little puzzled here. That the question before us is House File 4041. Can you draw a straight line for me between this bill and the conversation we're having on spring...
Oh, absolutely, Ms. Johnson. What we're doing is we're talking about in the bill, in the purview of the Ag Committee, aquaculture, and the bill has to do with aquaculture, and we're allowing ourselves to go a little bit... Well, no, we're not even going off the bill because it has to do with aquaculture, and that's what we're talking about today.
Are we going to be hearing from other aquaculture farmers?
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely. This is not specific to Spring Valley Ponds, although it seems to be taking quite a bit of our time. Representative Pennis.
Yeah, I think I've got, Mr. Chair, thank you, and I think I got a little bit more general questions here, Matt, you know, so we don't get real specific. The first one's for Mr. Lockesmall, and he'll understand me. Mr. Lockesmall, as I understood it from our last meeting, when water hits the air, it becomes waters of the state. Is that correct or not? Yes or no is sufficient.
Mr. Lockesmall?
No.
Okay, Mr. Chair and Mr. Lockesmall, when does it hit the air and not become water of the state?
Mr. Lockesmall? Representative Pence, waters of the state include all waters, both surface and underground. The discussion last time was when does it become surface water? When groundwater or water out of a spring is exposed to air, then it's called surface water.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Lockesmall. Thank you for clearing that up. So then it becomes public waters. And public waters means the state's responsibility. And, of course, we want to keep them clean, and we've got clean water legacies and whatnot else coming around. I get so perplexed because... take a navigable water, which is clearly under the jurisdiction of the DNR, and then it washes out a private driveway, let's say, and then the DNR says to me, this is local DNR, says, well, I can't do anything about that. You know, yet if it does that, it's a state responsibility because it's a public water. If the water flows over my farm and erodes it, and I have taken good precautions on preventing erosion, who's responsible, Maxine or the state? I'm just confused on that. And then I want to just say a little bit about pathogens. We're real concerned about pathogens, and we should be in the Ag Committee, especially when we talk about cervidae or fish farms or things like that. However, in the wild, we don't seem to get our arms around it because we take vast, vast tracts of land, especially in the northern half of this state, and we try to monitor them, I think, but you take a track of 700,000, 800,000, you know, go on up, acres of land, and then don't tell me, don't even try to tell me that there are no pathogens that come about that don't get into a trout stream or on another fish or whatever, that are natural pathogens. Evolution does occur. And I'm talking about the evolution nature. I know I came from an ape, but, you know, the rest of you didn't. I don't know if you have an answer for me, but some things are so clear-cut. and it's a 1, 2, 3. And then you get to other things, and they're just as loose as a goose.
I've got it. Members, if you could go to the last page that was in your second folder, not the one that had the bill in, and pull that out, just what Mr. Bond is in this case, and we've got another owner that we will hear from today. If you just go down through that, I mean, I've been hearing that, well, he's never had permits, he still doesn't have permits. And just go down through 1 through 10, point source permit filed, never received. State construction permit, paid a $12,000 fine with there's no admission of guilt. County road permit, received that. County CUP on hold for fee fishing. County building permit test on hold. The county zoning engineer was there when he's pouring concrete. After the fact permit fee for working in a trout stream paid 1.5 years ago, uncertain if needed, spring is not named as a tributary on the maps to Spring Valley Creek. Water appropriation permit, not required for any other hatchery. This is the only one. Federal permit to shoot predators, received. I'm not sure. I'm not going to go around that place. I'll tell you what. 9, floodplain letter, county on hold, waiting for things to settle. Hatchery license in dispute, it was received but then pulled. And then the question was why. I guess what my question is from this is, why is Spring Valley Ponds LLC being asked to do things or have permits that no one else has been asked to do or to have? Mr. Lochtesmal?
Mr. Chairman, if you would note on the handout that I provided, there are 48 active appropriation permits for aquaculture operations that are in existence in the state.
Oh, okay. Okay, thank you. Okay. Any more questions for members? Representative Magnus?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I see in the information Representative Johnson, I think, passed out to us that on April 12th, the Environmental Quality Board determined there was that an EAW is mandatory because on this project. It's my understanding that Fillmore County was going to be the responsible government unit. Is that correct?
Mr. Lockes? Commissioner?
I missed the very last part.
Is
Fillmore County supposed to be the responsible government unit, Commissioner, on this EAW?
Commissioner? Grant?
Chairman, Representative Magnus, yes.
Okay.
But let me clarify. And I don't have the material that Representative Johnson passed out, but that's okay. When it says the Environmental Quality Board determined on April 12th, I think the more accurate statement would be Environmental Quality Board staff sent some advisory or some communication that Fillmore County, that would be required.
Representative Magnus?
It looked like Pollution Control Agency had requested the EQB to determine whether, EQB staff, of course, to determine whether an EAW would be required back in May 27th of 05. And then there seems to be quite a time lag there. And I was just wondering where that process was sitting and wondering who the responsible government unit was. And it's my understanding that Fillmore County is responsible government. How is that, Mr. Chairman and Commissioner, how is that progressing? Do you anticipate that? What is the time frame on it, on the EAW? Do you see that being completed?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mangus, just reading some news accounts of EAW recently, together, I think, with conversations from our staff. My understanding is that Fillmore County, and this is hearsay, Mr. Chairman, so Fillmore County Board of Commissioners voted to ask that the EQB designate the DNR as the responsible governmental unit. And the EQB, under its rules, has the authority to change a responsible governmental unit. And Fillmore County has now asked for that. That's my understanding. That's not gone before the board yet, before the Environmental Quality Board. And I think it's anticipated that will happen in this month's board meeting. And again, it's based upon hearsay and what I read in the newspaper.
I think Mr. Broberg, were you at that meeting yesterday? Is the commissioner correct? Isn't it May 18th that comes before the board? I believe the board... We'll get to Mr. Broberg after a bit, and I think that that's what's happened with Magnus.
Well, my reason for asking these questions, Mr. Chairman, would it be an understanding of our committee here that the EAW would uncover a lot of the would answer a lot of the questions that are out there about this specific project? My understanding of an EAW is it would determine the need of an environmental assessment worksheet would be needed, and I don't know exactly how the EAW would be phrased there, but I would think you'd look at the temperature problem if that indeed is a problem there, and it would be my understanding that the EAW would uncover the answers that we're struggling for here. Both sides don't seem to be able to work out, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Pyre?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Magnus, that's exactly right, and I don't think an environmental assessment should be viewed as a negative. And had we started with that before any of the alterations had been made, we would have probably been able to answer a lot of the questions to start with. So that environmental assessment would answer a lot of those questions and provide the sideboards to help Mr. Bondas make a decision on how he'd want to operate.
Mr. Pyre, has an environmental assessment worksheet ever been requested for a fish farm before?
Mr. Chairman, Steve Hirsch is here. Steve is with Ecological Services and works with environmental assessments. I'm not aware of one, but he may be. I'll ask him.
Sir, if you could please step down and...
Well, Mr. Chairman, while they're coming down, I used to serve on the EQB, and we certainly had discussions about the abandoned mines up in northern Minnesota, if you recall that years ago, and talking about some of those being made into fish farms and everything else. So our aquaculture facilities, frankly, would be big, and I thought it would be good for the state. But I know we did talk... this has been quite a few years ago when I was served, but I know we did talk about that.
Sir, if you please state your name for the record and who you represent, please.
Mr. Chairman, Member Steve Hirsch, DNR Ecological Services. I'm not aware of any hatchery projects that have tripped this mandatory EAW category, but I'm also not aware of any hatchery projects that have been done since we've had this that have diverted or realigned a trout stream.
So there's never been one before in the history of the
Mr. Chairman, Representative Magnus was... correct that there was an EAW done on the operation that was conducted in the mine pits.
Yep.
Okay. Representative Welty. I'm sorry, Representative Magnus, you saw
this. Mr. Chairman, I did have a follow-up on this whole EAW thing.
Representative Magnus.
Gentlemen, could you tell me what you anticipate the cost for the EAW to be?
Mr. Hirsch?
For this specific project.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Magnus, I'm not sure what the cost would be for the RGU. I looked a little bit at some information from the City of Minneapolis, and they charge about $3,000 to $5,000 to administer an EAW. And so I'm assuming that might be close to their average cost. But a lot of the cost is borne by the project proposer who has to provide the data portions of the EAW, and that can really vary depending on the complexity of the EAW.
Representative Magnus?
That was my next question.
Representative Welty?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just starting to go over the back page of this document here that was handed out and just going through what the DNR has done and then what Mr. Bondus has done, and I just want to go through a few of these dates and then ask you, anybody up there, a question, whether it be Mr. Jason Meckel from Southeastern Minnesota Fisheries, DNR Fisheries, or others who've worked with Mr. Bondus. But September 15th, it says that Mr. Bondus refused to allow the PCA to place monitors at the spring and on the creek to measure the temperature of dissolved oxygen. April 8th, the DNR responds to the NPDES permit, raising concerns about the temperature, chemicals, type of fish, lack of information about the proposer's plans. May 31st, Mr. Bondus proposes to install between four and six 15,300-gallon tanks to raise walleyes. Then on October 5th, you know, Mr. Bondhus appeals the restoration order. And then just lately, Mr. Bondhus came before us and he showed us his plans for his hatchery, how he's going to have a public viewing area, which I would think that if he constructed it correctly is not going to have any effect, negative effect probably on the trout stream or on the discharge itself. But what I'm wondering is, as I go through this, I see that DNR sends letters and DNR requests information. When you have sent the requests, have you received back the plans from Mr. Bondhus regarding the temperature, regarding the fish that are going to be raised in these ponds, regarding his future plans?
Mr. Pyre?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Welty, that has been one of the frustrations, and I don't know how much is miscommunication, but since August of 2003, we've certainly encouraged Mr. Bondhus to work with our staff to develop a site plan. And I think it's one of those, we were looking for him to provide how he would operate so we could give guidance on whether that would need to be modified. And recently, he has asked us to put the sideboards on first, so we've done that. So I think December, it might have been early December of 2005, was the first time we received the first draft site plan.
Okay, so if I'm understanding you correctly, then you were in communication between August of 2003 and December of 2005, but it was in December of 2005 when you received the first actual plan that you could use to base your future decisions upon what was going to be permitted, what wasn't going to be permitted, and how you can move forward?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Welty, that's correct, and there had been an inquiry on exactly prior to that, what would a site plan need to include? And so we provided a listing of here's the parameters that we would look at initially for debate, and then based on that, the site plan on December 5th was submitted. We found that that didn't provide as much information as we required. Subsequent to that time, there was, I think he brought on the consultant, and there's been more detailed drafting of maps over the last probably couple of months. There's been more action in determining that site plan, but we didn't have the information to make the decisions on whether or not there'd be a negative resource impact until the initial information came in December.
We're so wealthy.
Thank you, Chair Davidson. And so then, since December of 2005, there has been progress made. You know, because the one thing I'm looking at is we've had this issue since August of 2003, but in actuality, we haven't had the documentation turned in until December of 2005 to really start moving the process forward where you can review a plan and determine your course of action based upon that plan. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Welty, that's correct. And I would say since December and up through our meeting last week, there's probably been significant progress in at least determining the parameters and helping us decide if there's going to be an impact and helping Mr. Bondhus determine how he might want to operate or if he could operate under the sideboards we provided.
Representative Welty.
Thank you, Chair David. So then, are we getting closer to the point where you can determine whether or not Mr. Bondhus will be in compliance and he will get his permit?
Mr. Pyre.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Welty, I believe we are certainly getting closer to be able to make that determination. Mr. Bondhus raised concerns from the fisheries end. We'd recommended a 55-degree effluent. He didn't feel that would be workable for the type of operations. But there's been some new temperature data, and they may share that today. So, yes, I think we're probably reasonably close for both Mr. Bondhus to determine how he could operate under the parameters or challenge the parameters we've had, and the state to make a determination on whether or not there would be negative resource impact.
Representative Welty.
Okay, and then just one follow-up question. Going back to September 15th of 2004 when supposedly Mr. Bonthus refused to allow the MPC to monitor the spring. Have you been able to do any monitoring since then so that you can bring this to a close, this issue of temperature to a close?
Mr. Meckel?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Welty, DNR Fisheries installed two temperature data loggers in Spring Valley Creek in about September of 2005, and we are currently monitoring water temperature upstream and downstream of the facility.
Thank you. Mr. Welty. Okay, and again, members, a couple things here. And first of all, who has driven more than 50 miles away that wishes to testify today that can't be here for another day? I believe we got somebody from Brainerd, is that correct? Somebody from Brainerd? Mr. Broberg, you're more than 50 miles away, but you'll be with us. Kellyanne? Okay. And again, you know, one thing that's been kind of interesting for me is you know, you hear you talk about rumors and speculation, and that's kind of how this place operates. But basically, the reason for these hearings, and some would say they're coming for special treatment or forgiveness, I just want to know what this guy has to do. And it doesn't have to be this guy. It can be anybody. My the Greg Davids Fish Farm in Canyon, Ojai County. What do I have to do? That's what I want to know. And we're just talking to good folks of the DNR today. Then you got the MPCA. Then you got the Department of Ag, which isn't, they don't really do much with it, but MPCA. And all I want to know, by the reason I'm holding these hearings, is what does someone have to do? This is a viable business in the state of Minnesota. There's 160-some fish farms or whatever Mr. Lacasmo said. What does someone have to do? And members, I want to be very, very clear, and this is something that never gets reported and never will. It's all about the environment. How many times have I said that? How many times have I said at the meetings we've been at? Mr. Pyre, is that correct? There's nobody here that wants to damage the environment that I'm aware of. But yet some of these things that are being printed and written is like, oh, my gosh, we're going to blow the place up. Representative
Pennant. I just have to say, all of us want to save the environment. Well, we want to save the environment both for the private citizen, private landowner, and the vast amount of state land. One interesting thing that I find is that, and this goes back to 91, 92, and I'm sure they'll look it up, the Department of Ag, you know, aquaculture we determined last time is under the Department of Ag, and that's why it fits in this committee. But then, and they're supposed to foster this and all this and help them obtain permits. And then all of a sudden, the commissioner comes up to be the commissioner of natural resources. And maybe we've cut the Department of Ag more than the Department of Natural Resources, because of course we're always cutting things, but they seem easier to work with.
Mr. Chairman, to that point,
or FMO?
Yeah. I wonder if the Department of Ag could come up briefly. I think Representative Pennis does bring up a good question in that it says in the statute 17.494, we went over this before, the commissioner shall act, and they're talking about the Department of Ag, the commissioner shall act as permit or license coordinator for aquatic farmers and shall assist aquatic farmers to obtain licenses and permits. It would seem to me that if there's going to be a challenge with the Department of Natural Resources or MPCA, the go-to agency, the original gatekeeper agency, should be the Department of Ag. It says so in statute. And I guess I'd like to know if the Department of Ag is aware of that. If they direct people to the Department of Natural Resources when there is a challenge. And if Mr. Bondas actually knew that.
Representative Mold, what does it say? It would be the coordinator for permits?
It says specifically the commissioner shall act as permit or license coordinator.
Could the Department of Ag come down for a second, please? And if the Department of Ag could let us know their coordinating activities.
Right. I mean, do they come to you and say, hey, you know, you got to go to the DNR about this?
If the gentleman, please identify yourself, you could address the question of Representative Mull.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Paul Strandberg with the Commissioner's Office of the Department of Agriculture. I have with me Richard Yingji, who has been connected with the aquaculture program within the Minnesota Department of Agriculture since it began, I believe. And indeed, basically, as I believe I said last time, we do not issue permits. We promote promote the aquaculture. But perhaps Mr. Jean could help you.
Well, for me, sir, if you please spell your last name for the record.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Richard Ian G. The last name is spelled J-I. J as in John.
Thank you, sir. Please provide your testimony.
I don't have any prepared testimony, but in response to the questions I asked here, yes, the Commission of Agriculture is supposed to coordinate the permits, and we do provide assistance to farmers such as Mr. Bondas, but unfortunately, most time the farmers or prospective fish farmers would call us, or either they, even if they go to call DNR, and DNR might refer them to us, whether it's in need of technical assistance, or where do I buy fish, or how do I get permits. Now, in a more difficult case, we certainly would advise fish farmers in terms of, okay, what you have to do. I mean, there are agencies, DNR is certainly involved, PCA could be involved, and local county or water district could be involved. Again, in this case, we unfortunately never heard from Mr. Bondas, and probably our fault as well. And in general, we promote and assist the development of aquaculture. However, we don't do anything in regulating the impact of aquaculture, whether it comes to natural resources or the environment. Excuse me. Those responsibilities are clearly delineated with the prospective agencies.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ball.
I'm sorry, sir. Could you give me the last name again?
G.
Mr. G. It says the commissioner shall act as permit or license coordinator for aquatic farmers and shall assist aquatic farmers to obtain licenses or permits. So my understanding of that is that in some way the Department of Agriculture should be interfacing with the counties. So if Mr. Bondas goes to the county, he should know that, or in some way, via the Department of Agriculture, that he might have an issue.
Mr. G?
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Representative Moe, if Mr. Bondas came to us, we certainly would have coordinated the permitting. And at one time, we did have a procedure adopted in somewhat formally coordinating the permitting process. But in the this started in the early 90s. In the 15 or so years of history, no one has triggered that procedure. Probably in a situation, say, I'm going to invest my money and start a business, should I deal with the permitting agencies myself, or should I put it in the hands of another agency? I mean, that's just speculation. But we have provided assistances in permitting process, but we have not, nobody has officially triggered the request and go into the formal coordination process.
Mr. G, I'm going to officially trigger a request, and I'd like a letter from you saying what Mr. Bondas or anyone in his situation, I'm not specific to Mr. Bondas, but what someone who has an existing fish farm permitted prior to 1992 would have to do with the DNR, the MPCA, the Department of Ag to acquire permits. If you could go through, you're the coordinator, if you could go through, I want in letter form all the hoops that someone would have to jump through to be properly permitted to operate a business. Because what I've been looking at this whole time is, like I said, what does someone have to do? I've never asked anybody to issue a permit. I've never said to anybody, you should issue a permit. All I've said is, how do you get a permit issued? What does one have to do to get a permit issued? That's all I want to know. if you could get that to me before our next meeting Tuesday, and then for the one Wednesday, and then the next week after that.
Mr. Chairman, to that point, I guess I would like to go a little bit further. I mean, we went through in this committee last year on working with the Department of Ag to come up with feedlot ordinances and outreach to the counties so they knew what standards that they needed to meet. I mean, it seems to me that the Department of Ag would, as the coordinator, should do something like that with agriculture. There should be actually a county administrator should be able to know or from the Department of Ag that, hey, these are the things that I need to look for when Chairman Davids goes out to Wilmer to open up his aquaculture facility. Your county administrator would say, well, by the way, you know, these are some things to look out for, and you might need to go to the Department of Ag and DNR.
Mr. Chair.
And members, we haven't even thrown into the mix the MPCA here yet.
Representative Junkie. Just to follow up on both your requests, also indicate to us any administrative rules that are in place regarding aquaculture, both now or that have recently been taken out of the rule books. So prior, you know, you said maybe there were some rules at one time, but now they're not there. And you had some specific guidelines and stipulations. If you could provide that, as well as just like with the feedlot rules, they're rules, not statutes, and be good to see if you have any administrative rules in place, too.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. And Representative Junkie, I'm not sure whether we adopted official rules. It's in the early to mid 90s, and back then we were involved in a lot of aquaculture activities. But since then we've gone through, the state has gone through a lot of changes, and the department probably has lost quite a bit of its staff. I certainly don't speak for the commissioner's office, and our work, to be honest, has shifted quite a bit as far as aquaculture is concerned. I mean, we still have, you know, aquaculture is still in my portfolio, but my vast workload is shifted away.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, sir.
I think I talking with Mr. G before the hearing, basically he said that the industry has been going away because of economics, for one thing.
Well, I can't imagine why.
Yeah.
Mr. G told me that after the Chisholm mine pit, the price of salmon went down from 3 to 2, and Chile took most of that. And with tilapia, the price has gone down, and really the only one still working on that is in Renville, and they can only do it in the live market because the southern part states have been taking the business away for us, and we have not had to put the resources into aquaculture that we did back when it came back in 91 and 92 when all those laws were passed.
Okay. Thank you. What we're going to do is, Representative Welty has a question, then we're going to go to the gentleman from Brainerd, because somebody that's driven that far, we want to hear from, and then we'll go to more questions. Representative Welty.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think that we have to take a serious look at what we currently have in statute, and what we have in statute, is it effective? And it's not. If it's not effective, then is there a better way for our state agencies to be working together? And, you know, I look at it, and from what Mr. Xi said, for him to be in the position that he's in and not to actually officially go through a permitting process with anyone over the past 9 years, was that correct, did you say?
Mr. G?
Mr. Chairman and Representative, I wouldn't say we have not gone through with anybody with a permitting process. What I was saying, and I apologize if I wasn't clear earlier, that what I was saying, that nobody officially triggered the process, but we did go through with some fish farmers with their permitting process. And to that point, Mr. Chairman, response to earlier comments, with Mr. Bondas, I'd be happy to look into his situation and work with him any way we could. Again, I regret that we never found his efforts before, and he never found us before. It's kind of unfortunate, and we still, to this day, from time to time, to receive phone calls from fish farmers or prospective fish farmers in terms of what they attempt to do and counsel them, what they need to do, whether technically or regulatory-wise.
Thank you. With that, we'll go to Mr. John Reynolds.
Mr. Chair, just a comment while they're all leaving. Just to Mr. G and to DNR and to MPCA, it seems like part of the issue could have been resolved if everyone was referring people who inquire about permits to the one-point person that can work them through the process. And maybe the DNR or MPCA can answer to that later on, but you know, I'm wondering if Mr. Xi hadn't been contacted about Mr. Bondhus's request that he couldn't have helped Mr. Bondhus through this process.
Thank you, Representative Wilson. Okay, with that, and again, members, we will, we've got the room till 5, so we will, there was no one else here that necessarily wanted to testify that couldn't be here at another meeting. Okay, Mr. Reynolds, welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
My name is John Reynolds, and I have a small fish farm near Brainerd, Minnesota.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you for allowing me to shed some light on why Minnesota doesn't have an aquaculture industry. I think you've seen a little bit of it. I returned to school, and I worked very hard. I graduated with honor from the top aquaculture program in the United States, and then I made the mistake of moving to Minnesota. As long as the Minnesota DNR regulates aquaculture, no amount of hard work can fix my mistake. This state has everything a state needs to develop a major sustainable aquaculture industry. We have abundant clean water, suitable soils, suitable topography, strong workforce, and a favorable climate for fish culture. Unfortunately, what we also have is a regulatory agency that is determined to prevent the growth of aquaculture at any cost, and no amount of work will fix that. Just because you are licensed to raise a fish species does not mean I will let you raise it. That paraphrases what my regional DNR fisheries manager told me in 2001. He's the same manager who approved my newer ponds for all Minnesota species. My original ponds that were approved by the previous manager were also licensed for all Minnesota species since 1997. The first species that they attacked me with is orange spotted sunfish. And I reported raising orange spotted sunfish in 2000 to the DNR on my annual report form. My regional manager's denial to let me continue raising that species cost my small farm a $10,000 order, and my farm is still crippled. I was just picking up speed, and the loss of that order forced me to go back to work. The reason the regional manager gave for denying the species is provably false, but the facts don't matter when you deal with the DNR. The regional manager first said that my farm was within the 25-year floodplain. That's false. A 1996 internal DNR memo sent to Mr. Hirsch stated that my farm was out of the 100-year floodplain. 2 years later, the regional manager admitted that he had no information supporting his claim that my farm was in a 25-year floodplain, so he just changed. He said it was because of the threat of a heavy rainfall. I carry an extra 36 inches of dike on my largest ponds. It would take a 37-inch rainfall to overfill them. The official state record is 11 inches. He's also used the excuse of a flood that would put the city of Brainerd 20 feet underwater, or the risk that I might forget and leave my pump on for over a month and not notice that the ponds were overfilling. From the time the regional manager approved all my ponds for all Minnesota species to the time he removed most of them, including local species, nothing about my farm changed. My farm didn't move, it didn't sink down into the 25-year floodplain, and it has no violations, no complaints. The only thing that did change was that 6 weeks before he told me, just because you were licensed to raise the fish species does not mean I will let you, I had filed an ethics complaint against one of the top DNR officials for giving false testimony to this legislature. The Minnesota DNR Fisheries has been openly retaliating against my farm ever since, and I don't see an end to it. DNR Commissioner Gene Merriam is aware of it. Deputy Commissioner Mark Holston is aware of it. Fisheries Director Ron Pyre is aware of it. I believe that this retaliation will continue as long as the DNR is allowed to regulate aquaculture. If I could move out of this state, I wouldn't be here. Excuse me, I'm kind of angry. I've mortgaged my home, and there's no way I can move. Thank you for your time.
Any questions of Mr. Reynolds? Or from Magnus?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Reynolds, where'd you go to school at?
Auburn.
Okay. Yep.
Auburn.
Well, I was just checking and wanted to make sure we both thought that Auburn was the best fishing school. Anybody know that?
What's the mascot there?
A tiger.
That's right.
Like everybody didn't know that. You didn't? Thank you, Mr. Reynolds. Georgia, isn't it?
Yep.
Georgia? Representative Pennis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to ask one question. When you came, when you started your fish, your aquaculture, and you applied for a license, it wasn't an aquaculture farm before prior to you?
Mr. Chair?
Reynolds?
Mr. Chair, member Pennis? No, it was not. I built the ponds. Those are man-made ponds.
Okay. Mr. Chair, then, how long did it take you from the time of, deciding you were going to do this to the time that you got it stocked and was up and going?
Mr. Reynolds?
Mr. Chair, next member Pennis, are you talking about going to school or just from the time I started digging?
From the time, Mr. Chair, from the time that you settled down and decided this is what you were going to do, I mean, you're done with school, I assume, and then we're going to start this aquaculture. How long does it take to get the permit, to go from, I'm here and I want to get the permit?
Mr. Reynolds?
Chair, members, getting the first permit took me no time. I built the ponds. I applied for the permit. At that time, I had a working relationship with the DNR, and there was no issue. It wasn't
Reynolds,
until after.
Did you lay any concrete down?
No.
You did?
I knew better.
Was there any trout stream within 100 miles?
Stony Creek or Stony Brook in Pequot.
How far is that?
50 miles or okay. Less.
So he didn't. Was that 97?
Mr. Chair, actually, I built my first ponds in 96. They were partially licensed for species, and then I added all the rest in 1997, and there was no problem with that.
And you moved dirt?
Correct.
Chairman?
Okay, Representative Bangus.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Reynolds, are you rearing species of fish that are indigenous to Minnesota also?
Mr. Reynolds?
Mr. Chair, Member Mangus, actually they're all from Minnesota.
Okay.
But I understood here that the sunfish are not indigenous to, orange-spotted sunfish was not indigenous to Minnesota, is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Member, that is not correct.
Okay.
They are found naturally in about a third of Minnesota.
Mr. Magnus?
But not his watershed.
Oh, well, I was looking here to understand this, because it is aquaculture, Mr. Chairman, is a complex subject.
Finding
that out.
Yeah.
And it is. And it's frustrating, because it is very complex, because you're talking hatcheries, fishery, rearing, marketing of this, indigenous, non-indigenous, and we're seeing here one group says it's it's indigenous, the other group saying no, it's not, and it is very complex. Mr. Reynolds, do you know a guy went to Auburn School named Dr. Mike Kramer, by chance?
Mr. Reynolds?
Mr. Chair, Member Magnus, I don't remember.
Okay.
That was back in 1990.
So, Magnus?
Well, I just wanted to... he's a good friend of mine. I've been to a lot of fish farms around the world with Mr. Kramer.
Mr. Reynolds, do you know Bo Jackson?
Mr. Chair, no.
He was a really good ball player.
Yeah. Mr. Chair.
Oh, but Bo knows you, I bet.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to comment that not only did they take off non-indigenous species, they also took off some that are half a mile from my farm.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Moll.
I'm guessing you're going to bring the DNR back to respond to it's a pretty potent case, and I think I'd like to hear from them.
We can certainly do that.
Yeah.
And just so folks know, we have the next Tuesday and Wednesday, the room's booked till 8, from 2:30 to 8, and then we have the next Tuesday and Wednesday. And so I just like this committee. It's a really good committee. So that's what we're looking at. And just so folks know, because there's a lot of sides to every story, we're keeping track of time on people that are kind of for things and people are kind of against things, because we'll be very fair, and I always give equal time to both sides. That never makes it in the papers either. But with that being said, we will go to anyone that wishes from the DNR to respond, and then it's my intention to go to Mr. Harry Gallagher, Dick Sternberg, Rebecca Cluckhorn is where we'll go after that. And then folks that wish to respond to anything else that might have a different view will certainly be given equal time, since I am the fair chairman. Okay, with that, Mr. Gallagher, if you could please step down. Oh, I'm sorry, DNR first. I'm sorry, Mr. Gallagher. DNR in response to Mr. Reynolds.
Almost worked.
Did you draw the short straw?
Mr. Pyre, any comments on the testimony of Mr. Reynolds?
What
did you know and when did you know it?
Mr. Chairman, we've been dealing with Mr. Reynolds and certainly are aware of his frustration for the past decade. From our perspective, we've done our best just to try to prevent species from moving around in watersheds, and we've had some disagreement. Orange-spotted sunfish are a species, and maybe an easier comparison. We don't want sauger to get into the Mille Lacs Lake watershed, even though they're fairly close. So even though fish are fairly close, there are certain watersheds and even individual lakes where we don't want fish to move around. And movement of fish, whether they're non-native to a given lake or watershed or whether they're invasive species, are concerns that we'll be dealing with for a long period of time. My understanding with Mr. Reynolds was that part of his ponds on one side of the road were licensed for non-indigenous, and he desired to have ponds on the other side licensed for non-indigenous. We were concerned that that dike might get breached, whether it was floodplain or not, and the fish that he would rear would have a direct run into the Mississippi River. And he'd offered, I believe, in 2001 to put a secondary barrier that would prevent fish, or at least help prevent fish from moving should that occur. And I don't know if we ever reached that point. So maybe that's, we've certainly tried to work, John would disagree with the level of that, but we've tried to do the best we can to keep his operation going. And I just comment in terms of aquaculture in general, and I'm more familiar with walleye and where we're rearing fish, the number of licensees and the number of acres licensed for aquaculture has increased quite a bit over the past few years. We license over 2,000 wetlands and 45,000 acres for walleye rearing, and some of the food sources there's been a competition issue. So the agency is certainly supportive of the aquaculture industry, but we would like to work with them to do all our best to protect the resources as they endeavor.
Representative Moll, and then pass. Representative Moll.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We have a copy of the permit that Mr. Reynolds got from the DNR from 96, and apparently something has changed from 96 until 2001, where the permit was no longer allowed. Could you explain that to me,
Mr. Pyre?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Moll, the recollection, and my understanding of this, is when that initial license was approved, there was a note that it was approved for all requested species. But upon further review and a closer review, some of those species raised a lot of concern for us. And a lot of the concern with invasives and species moving around the watersheds have occurred within the last 10 or 15 years. So we're certainly more conscious of some of the problems. So, you know, I think my understanding of the situation is that they were approved. The field staff out there recognized there were some species on there that they had concerns with, and those species were restricted to one side of his operation and not the other, pending the placement of that barrier.
Just clarification. So then now after 2001, just for clarification, then half this native species have to be on one side of the road, non-native on the other, but he's still permitted for both, correct?
That's my understanding. I haven't dealt directly with it recently, but my understanding is if his ponds are configured the way they were, and he could certainly comment to that, then that's the case. We've never dropped the non-indigenous on the other ponds, and we would not permit non-indigenous species on the ponds on the one side of the road until such a barrier went in. So I'm not aware that has changed, but I'm not absolutely certain of that, Representative Moe.
Representative Moe?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Pence.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. You said that several wetlands, aquaculture has increased in size as far as a number of acres in the last few years. Are those private wetlands?
Mr. Pyre?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pennis, no. Most of those are public wetlands.
Right. That's very understandable. Did it take long for the permits on those? And then what does the DNR do about natural events? Because you're responsible for all of the environment and the fish, let's talk aquaculture, that's going on in the state. What do you do about natural events that occur where whatever species gets loose? I mean, that's why we've got some of the problems we do have. But everybody loves natural events. They have no problem with nature taking its course, but they don't realize that it does take a course. It is moving on, and we're not. We're just making more laws to tie up private people. I don't know if you can answer that.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Pennis, there certainly are natural events. I think we're all aware of the high waters in 93 that moved minnows all over in our wetlands, and you can't control a lot of that, and that certainly caused concern for waterfowl production, and we're working on that. You can try to mitigate through controlling where tiles go and doing that to some extent, but some of the things we simply don't have control of, and some things we do. And where we have these major concerns, and you look at the proliferation of species like zebra mussels and round gobies, and now we've got New Zealand mud snails, and it just seems like every week or two we're getting a new exotic, and so we're trying to do our best. Minnesotans are pretty well aware of that, and they're very conscious and doing what they can, and so we're just trying to do whatever we possibly can to, if not stop it, deter it enough to allow us to develop other mechanisms to control it. But you're right, there's some things that are beyond our control.
Just as a follow-up, you don't have to answer this, but Would you think that a controlled ecosystem such as Mr. Reynolds has with this aquaculture, or somebody else may get in the future, would probably do more to prevent movement of the fish in a natural event than we're doing naturally, you know, on all our vast amount of public water? You know, it's so sometimes we overkill. I think that's a good term in biology, too.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Pennis, depending on the species and what's moving around, some things are certainly more harmful. Usually the type of facility that Mr. Reynolds and a number of other aquaculturists have are just fine, and we've permitted a lot of them. The particular case here, though, is we were just concerned with the breach of a dike, and we do take a conservative view of that. Once you get these species started, it's almost impossible to remove them, and then we're dealing with damage control. The common carp is an example of that for years.
Okay, members, I said we were here till 5. Actually, there's another committee meeting coming in at 5, so we'll be here till about 1:45. And members, as far as the future meetings on this issue, as needed, they're contingent upon floor session. We didn't have any floor today, so it worked out good. So anyone, if you could contact Chris, the committee legislative assistant, it's my intention to have a meeting at 2:30 on Tuesday, contingent upon floor session. If we're at floor session, of course, we won't meet. So if you could get on a list to, like, Jeff and others, if you could contact Chris with some phone numbers so that we'll probably know by Monday night what we're doing Tuesday, and if it's highly likely that we'll be on the floor, we will contact the people on that list so they don't make a special trip in here if we're not going to be meeting. So that being said, Harry Gallagher, if you could please step down, and you've got some comments you'd like to make, and Mr. Gallagher's legal counsel for Mr. Bondas and Spring Valley Ponds. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Thank you, Chairman. Members, Harry Gallagher with Lockridge, Grindle, Nowen. I'm the attorney for Spring Valley Ponds. We were retained in February of 05. I would like to give just a brief overview. You've gotten a little bit of history about the facility, what's happened and what hasn't happened. I'd like to elaborate on that a little bit, as well as correct a few comments and make my observations on some materials that you've been given today. First, the commissioner, with all due respect, indicated that what was handed out that was given to the Office of Administrative Hearings were facts. If you start on page 2, you'll note the paragraphs that he referred to as facts are really captioned under the category allegations. These are the DNR.
They're what?
They're allegations.
Well, allegations, okay.
These are the DNR.
I have a lot of those.
Yes.
Yeah.
These are the DNR allegations regarding Spring Valley Ponds. The facts will be determined by the administrative law judge.
Thank you for that point.
Going back to the beginning, Spring Valley Ponds purchased an existing hatchery in July of 2003. A hatchery that was licensed, had its waters on the approved water list, and had a fish hatchery license. To my knowledge, it was not a hatchery that had a water appropriation permit, even though all the water from the spring flowed through the ponds and then indirectly into Spring Valley Creek. Following Mr. Bondas' purchase and Spring Valley Ponds' purchase of the property, between August 2003 and February 2005, as has been indicated, there were numerous conversations and communications back and forth between primarily DNR and Spring Valley Ponds. These communications were requests for information, disagreements regarding whether or not a water appropriation permit would apply, inquiries on whether this was really a public waters or not, inquiries that are still continuing today at this hearing, questions regarding what species could be raised at the facility. And then there was some discussion about a site plan. There was a discussion about a site plan back in February of 2005. At that time, DNR indicated that the site plan should include three things: a location of the ponds, the outlet structures from the ponds, and the methods for fish containment. Since then, the requirements for a site plan have become much more extensive and include modeling, temperature profiles, yearly water usage monitoring and modeling, much more than what was originally required.
So, Mr. Gallagher, again, what was the original request? What you said, three things?
Three things: the location of the ponds, the outlet structures, and methods for fish containment.
Okay, please proceed.
Even though there was back and forth during that time period, there was progress made. During that time period, as indicated by DNR, they approved the transfer of the license from the prior owner to Spring Valley Ponds. The DNR also indicated to Spring Valley Ponds that an after-the-fact public waters permit would be acceptable to deal with the issues in terms of the work that was done allegedly within the public waters.
So they said that was okay?
They did indicate at that time that that was an acceptable solution and that Spring Valley Pond could, in fact, apply for an after-the-fact public waters permit, which it has done and has paid for. We were told that it would issue in, I believe, June of 04. It is yet to issue.
Okay, please proceed.
DNR also expanded the list of species to be raised at Spring Valley Ponds facilities, increasing the species by 44. All of them were indigenous to the area, and DNR indicated in its approval that non-indigenous species would be looked at in the future when they had more information about fish containment. During that same time period, Spring Valley Ponds undertook a number of activities as well. As you indicated, it submitted and paid for, after the fact, public waters permit. It provided DNR with the information it believed was being requested for a site plan. It submitted a permit for water appropriation, even though it believed that appropriating the water from a free-flowing spring that flowed through the ponds, a permit was not required, and there was still back and forth regarding the amount of the fee. Part of what the bill is today is, of course, to cap the fee at $750. I think if all the water was charged for, it would be in the thousands of dollars. Spring Valley Ponds also submitted an application for a voluntary NPDES SDS point source permit, even though its operations at the facility would not trigger the mandatory levels requiring such a permit from the MPCA. And it filed its application and received a permit for an NPDES construction stormwater permit. So by February of 2005, permit applications had been received, and Mr. Bondas thought he was on the way. There was clearly still some disagreement regarding some of the information submitted, and there was back and forth between Mr. Bondas and primarily DNR. In February 2005, right before we were retained, the Pollution Control Agency issued a 10-day letter to Spring Valley Ponds, indicating that it had started construction without an NPDES stormwater construction permit. Mr. Bondas at that time retained our firm to assist him with that matter. That enforcement action was subsequently resolved by the parties entering into a stipulation agreement in December of 2005, pursuant to which Spring Valley Ponds agreed to pay the MPCA a $12,500 fine.
Without admitting guilt?
Pardon? Without, correct.
Okay.
Without admission of any guilt. Following our retention, I contacted the DNR to find out what the status of the permits and processes were, because it was clear from the paper file that there had been a lot of back and forth, and that it looked like there had been some confusion in terms of what was being requested and how it was being delivered. So I made contact with DNR, introduced myself, and indicated that I would like to try to get things back on track and see if we can move the permitting process forward. Based on the information in the file that we had looked at, it made sense to me that we would have a joint meeting between DNR and MPCA so all the players could come to one room together, and hopefully we'd get all the information that we'd need, know what permits were needed, what was missing, and the time frames for satisfying the permits so Mr. Bondas could move forward with the facility. During that same time period, as I mentioned, there was an NPDES SDS point source permit that an application was made for. The MPCA public noticed that permit, and it went out on the EQB register for public comment. In April of 2005, Mr. Madigan, representing the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, Trout Unlimited, and Minnesota Trout Association, submitted comments per his right on that public notice permit. Some of his comments also included a question on whether an EAW, an environmental assessment worksheet, for this facility was needed. He stated four grounds why he thought a permit may be needed. Based on that request, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency referred the decision on whether an EAW was in fact needed or not over to the Environmental Quality Board, since there were numerous agencies involved, Pollution Control Agency being one, DNR being another, Fillmore County being the third. Both Pollution Control Agency and DNR indicated for the categories which they would normally be the responsible governmental unit that no EAW would be needed.
Who said that?
Both DNR and the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, for the categories that they would, by rule, be the responsible governmental units.
Okay.
They indicated that there was no permit or no environmental assessment needed. Fillmore County did not weigh in right away, and DNR subsequently amended and supplemented its response, saying that they thought that perhaps there had been work done in the public water, and there had been a realignment of a trout stream, which would trigger an EAW for which Fillmore County would be the responsible governmental unit. We had our first joint meeting in May of 2005, DNR, PCA, and I believe someone from Rocky Sisk, who's kind of the liaison to try to help businessmen navigate through the permitting process, facilitated that at our request. At that meeting, we discussed a number of things. Primary issue that was discussed was that the DNR was concerned about temperature. We were aware of that. That was one of their comments to the NPDES permit. It was also acknowledged that the NPDES permit would be the appropriate avenue to deal with permitting and temperature issues, and it would be a condition of the permit. At the meeting, we also discussed the fact that this pending decision by the EQB was out there, and as a result, the Pollution Control Agency warned and cautioned everyone that no permitting decisions could be made until the Environmental Quality Board acted and made a decision on whether or not an environmental assessment worksheet was needed. As we know, that decision was just made last month. So in the meantime, no permits for this facility could issue, even if the agencies would have wanted to issue them. As a result of that meeting, there was no communication between the DNR and my client until August of 2005, when Commissioner Miriam sent a letter to my client indicating that three actions that have been mentioned, removing his ponds from the approved water list, revoking his hatchery license for those ponds, and issuing a cease and desist order and restoration order, would be forthcoming. Upon receipt of that letter, my client immediately sent it to me. We sent a response to the DNR asking for a meeting and requesting that the commissioner not issue that order until we had a chance to meet with him. Simply for the sake that we hadn't heard anything for a number of months, we were waiting for the EQB decision to be made, and no one had asked us for anything since the May meeting, and there was no expectation in our minds from the May meeting that anything would be delivered until after we knew what was going to happen from the environmental assessment worksheet standpoint. That letter and request went unanswered. In September, the commissioner issued his order. We then requested a meeting with the commissioner, which he accommodated, to make our case for the fact that he should rescind his order and allow us to continue to work cooperatively to address DNR's concerns to move this project forward, so once the EQB had acted, we could hit the ground running and proceed with the permitting process. Unfortunately, the commissioner declined that invitation from us and decided that the route that we would need to take would be to appeal his orders, which, of course, we needed to do in order for Mr. Bondas not to be shut down completely at that time. During the meeting with the commissioner, it was clear that there had been frustration from the DNR standpoint in terms of communications or, in their mind, lack of communication with our client. Likewise, we made clear to the DNR that there had been communication problems from their end. There were numerous requests from the DNR, sometimes from fisheries, sometimes from waters, sometimes conflicting, for different pieces of information. Mr. Bond has tried to comply, but each time he thought he had done something, a different division or a different agency would ask him for new information. Again, there had been no communications from May through August, despite the fact that DNR claimed that there had been requests for information. None of those were made through my office, for whom the DNR knew we represented Mr. Bondas, nor were there any communications directly with Mr. Bondas. Unfortunately, we had to appeal the order. Since that time, however, we've continued to work with DNR because we believe that it is in both parties' best interest to negotiate the solution to this problem, provide the DNR with the information that they need, and to proceed with the NPDES permit and now apparently with an environmental assessment worksheet. We've met with DNR, and as Mr. Pyre indicated, I think the meetings, while some of them have been a little frustrating, I think, for both parties, I think they've been progressing, albeit slowly, sometimes a step forward and two steps backward, but I think we're starting to discuss the issues and get them out on the table where we can actually hopefully make some progress. However, since this committee last met 2 weeks ago, I believe, unfortunately, the commissioner's office has decided that those meetings maybe aren't as productive as they would like, and for some reason have decided to escalate the enforcement action by noticing the pre-hearing conference and proceeding down a dual path, apparently, of litigating the matters and whether Mr. Bondas' permits were correctly pulled or not, despite the assurances that we've been given that if we are able to satisfy DNR and work through the issues, those permits would be reinstated. Now Mr. Bondas is in a position of having to not only spend time and expense on one side trying to negotiate them, or my time and the consistent time and expense, but now we have to spend the added expense of litigating against the DNR to regain those permits. It's kind of a double-edged sword. We feel we need to do both, simply because I think it's still productive to try to settle this issue. However, the DNR is forcing our hand, and we will need to litigate it as well. Interestingly enough, most of these issues didn't arise until Mr. Madigan submitted his comments to the MPDS source point permit. And while we have not been always the recipient of information from the DNR, it appears that Mr. Madigan and his groups have been the recipients of information actually in advance of us receiving things. Most recently, Mr. Madigan called my office and indicated that he wanted to intervene in the pre-hearing conference in front of the administrative law judge. This was before we had received any documents from the DNR indicating that a pre-hearing conference had been scheduled. In fact, I think it predated the date of the letter from DNR. So, obviously, Mr. Madigan has an inside source that he's getting information from much sooner than the regulated body, which is somewhat frustrating because I'm happy to see him in the contested case hearing. At least we'll be able to discuss the matters directly and face-to-face, and I won't wonder what he's getting that I don't have.
Could you repeat that? He was getting things before you were?
He knew about the contested case hearing and indicated he wanted to intervene in that before we had been served with papers from the DNR, correct?
How did he know that?
I do not know.
Okay, please continue.
In summary, as I said, this was a pre-existing facility that we have attempted to work out with both permitting and enforcement actions with both DNR and PCA. We are unaware of any facility, including DNR's own facilities, which have been required to submit information to the level and the level of detail that Spring Valley Ponds is being requested to submit in advance of applying for an MPDS permit or in advance of an environmental assessment worksheet. We are unaware of any facility, including DNR's, with operational limits being placed on a hatchery that will be as stringent as those being proposed on Spring Valley Ponds. We are unaware of any EAWs being required of a hatchery for the type of work that Spring Valley Ponds allegedly did, or in other words, realignment of a tributary, not the springs, I want to make clear, not the creek bed, but of a tributary leading to a creek, a tributary that had been in existence, if you want to call it a tributary, as trout ponds since the 1940s. I believe DNR has done similar type of work in its facilities, including installing piping, etc., without the necessity of an EAW. This facility, last time I think there was some confusion on whether there was an appropriation of water or a new appropriation of water. This facility has no new appropriation of water. As I started my comments, the water has historically flowed from the spring through the ponds that were in existence on the property since the 1940s and then into the creek. Nothing has changed. In fact, Mr. Bondas has agreed and has been willing to accommodate DNR's request that any unused water, water that he does not need for the fisheries, would be directly routed to the creek to improve the temperature profile and flow of the creek rather than flowing through all the ponds that's historically been the case. It's in conclusion, you know, the actions taken by the commissioner in revoking the permits we believe were arbitrary and unwarranted. We still hope that we can work out without litigation these permitting issues with the Department of Natural Resource and proceed to put Mr. Bondas back in operation. But as it stands right now, with some of the conditions being placed on it, he has serious concerns on whether he would be able to viably operate his business. Thank you.
Mr. Gallagher, I've got a question. I'm referring to the Broberg letter of April 28th in the Fillmore County Journal. It says that Mr. Bondas is now seeking special treatment from the legislature. Can you tell me what that special treatment is? I'm not aware of any.
I'm not aware of any special treatment he's seeking.
And you are representing Mr. Bondas in the same Broberg letter of April 28th. Are you aware of any request for forgiveness? Because you haven't asked me for forgiveness yet.
No, in fact, we just want to have a clear path that we need to navigate so we know how to get the permits and move on to operation.
Well, that clears that up. Thank you. Okay, any questions for Mr. Gallagher?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Johnson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I'm still thinking about the free fishing day on Sunday, April 30th, 2006, and the reply when I first brought the question up had to do with a cease and desist order and the requirement to remove fish within 60 days. If I understand a timeline here, that order would have been someplace around August 29th, 2005. So
if the fish had been removed within 2 months, how did the fish get back in there? Or can you explain the presence or absence of fish over that time?
Representative Johnson, I believe that was answered before, because there's a request for a hearing that suspended that 60-day period. Is that correct, Mr. Gallo?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, that is correct. Pursuant to Minnesota rules and statutes, Mr. Bond has appealed the commissioner's orders, which put them in abeyance. In other words, they were on hold pending the hearing in front of the administrative law judge. So the fish did not need to be removed within that 60-day period.
Representative Johnson.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. So the fish were still there. They hadn't gone anyplace. Would it have been, in your view, complying with the current circumstances to hold a public gathering at this time with the administrative hearing under discussion?
Mr. Gallagher?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, I do not think it was inconsistent with the cease and desist order, as that was in advance. And I think the Department of Natural Resources agreed with that conclusion.
I believe the commissioner stated he agreed with that. Representative Johnson?
Thanks.
Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Gallagher? With that, I had Mr. Gallagher, Mr. Sternberg, and Rebecca Cluckhone. I had no one else on here. If there's anybody else who wishes to testify next Tuesday, please get your name on the list. We'll give equal time to proponents and folks that have concerns. So that good government all the time. We are adjourned.